the method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to episode 18 of Unsigned Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin.
For those of you tuning in for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow writers about their process and craft.
In this episode, we're joined by Mark Nash, who is most recently the author of Three Dreams in the Key of G, which was out on Dead Ink.
We spoke to Mark at the end of last year in London, but we're actually now recording this intro on different sides of the globe. I'm speaking from Thailand at the moment, slightly warmer and more tropical than when we recorded the episode itself.
So can you see the sea from where you're sat?
Not from where I'm sat. I'm inside at the moment, but I'm a stone's throw from the sea. Uh-huh. I may go outside into the sea after we finish recording this.
So Mark Nash.
So yeah, we had a good conversation last year. Mark's book, for those that haven't read Three Dreams in the Key of G, is quite experimental and takes place from three different perspectives, one of them being the DNA chromosome itself, and it was interesting to hear his approach.
He sort of sets himself up for very intense periods of writing in the summer holidays, doesn't he, which I think is both.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. He'd have a sort of gestation period of sort of 6 months, and he'd have the idea and then mull it over without making any notes, and then just sit down and bash the whole book out in the space of a few weeks, which is an interesting approach, I thought.
Yeah, it'd be quite good to try.
Yeah.
He also spoke to us about his editing process, and how he, unlike a lot of us, myself included, for which editing means hacking a lot of stuff away and cutting to the bone, he actually sees his projects grow considerably during editing. It's a lot of putting stuff, material in.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me personally, my approach to writing is very much the opposite in both respects. It's a sort of drawn out process to get words down on the page rather than writing a whole book in a few weeks. And the editing process is very much cutting back rather than adding new material in.
Yeah. So, ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, Mark Nash.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
If we start maybe talking a little bit about your routine in writing, if you have one. Do you have a particular place or time that you
like
to
write?
Well,
I used to have a particular place because I basically moved from writing stage plays to prose when my twins arrived. So I had a study. But as they got older and homework and stuff, I basically gave it up to them. So I've ended up like Dame Barbara Cartland, and I write lying on my bed on my laptop. And in terms of routine, I was the main child rearer and I had a part-time job. So the way I used to do it was to basically blitz write in my summer holidays. I'd take all my holiday at once, 3 weeks, and try and get the first draft of a piece done then. And then over the Christmas break, which was effectively 2 to 3 weeks as well, that's when I'd, knock it into shape. So that's kind of the practicalities of it. But the way I sort of prepare for novels is once I have the sort of starting image or theme or metaphor together with the voice, then I don't do anything for 6 months. I just let it see the way in the subconscious. So that when I do come down to write, it's pretty much formed, although I've not made notes but in that sort of blitz writing period, it comes out almost of a piece because it has, I've been working on it, but, not in a sort of joined up way.
Yeah.
And that's, for me, that's sort of the most exciting stage.
That's quite a long time. Do you put pen to paper at all in that 6 month period?
Not on that project. I mean, I do write lots of sort of flash fiction.
Would you write even like a reminder of this is the image or the idea?
I might make the odd note, but what I definitely wouldn't do is start writing scenes. I absolutely don't do that. Because when I say I blitz write, I very much build up a momentum. I'm a sort of a momentum writer and I use music to get me back into the atmosphere, the next morning after I've broken off. So it'll be the same playlist for each project, which is tailored as much as I can. So, yeah, I try not to, in that 6 months, I try not to broach it consciously.
What draws you to the tunes for the playlist?
Like, well, it has to be relevant to the book. Mm-hmm. I worked 19 years in a record shop, so I have a pretty good...
Okay. with Three Dreams and the Key of G, it's when you're writing sections in Northern Ireland, I'm sure we'll come to this, but was the place that the songs were from important? All this sort of
I was listening to sort of The Undertones and Rudy and Stiff Little Fingers. But I think of all my projects, it probably was least influenced or least relied on a music soundtrack because there were three very different tones and moods. So, for example, my debut novel was set in the sort of the clubs of sort of Greece, you know, the sort of 1830 sort of resorts. So that was a mixture of trance, because that's the music that was being played then, and sort of Greek rebetika music, which is sort of the Greek blues, which... suited the two sides of the novel, but there's so many sides in Three Dreams that it was harder to sort of... So I probably, you know, just played music, really. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And with that leading up to the period of Blitz writing,
yes.
When you were working that way, did you feel a particular kind of pressure if the summer holidays were herring towards you?
Oh, yes.
You hadn't quite thought things through as much as you
wanted? Oh, well, I see, in terms of the build-up to that break. No, it was... It doesn't have to be a calendar 6 months. I knew that was my 3 week writing window. That's when I would sit down and write. And during that period, I don't sleep much. I mean, I'm a sort of insomniac anyway. And you begin to resent things like breaks for food and things like, you know, it's, you know, my children didn't see much of me, you know, in those periods, which is also their summer holiday as well, of course. So, you know, when they were young, I sort of packed them off to sort of football summer schools and things like that. And wrote when they were asleep, you know, I wrote through the night. So no, when you know you've got that three week window and you can't change it, you just have to, you know, sit down and start on day one.
Power on.
Yeah, basically.
When going back to that, the sort of initial idea,
yeah.
Do you know when it comes to you that is in 6 months' time you're going to be writing this, or do you have multiple different ideas all bubbling under and slowly one of them coalesces into a novel?
Well, that's definitely the case in that because, you know, I worked and stuff, or still do, I'm always playing catch up with my own material. So that's certainly true. But the one that forces its way to the front of the queue, as it were, when that central image comes together with the voice, even though I'm not writing anything down, there will be a sort of a surge, a spate of stuff. And then when you're in that torrent, you kind of think, yeah, this is the one that I'll be going with.
And that's quite quickly after coming up with the idea. So well, in a matter of that day, you'd be like, oh, I think there's legs to this.
Yes, I think what takes a long time is to find the right central theme with the right voice. But once they coalesce, that there's some sort of alchemy or whatever, fusion, and you know, then the rest sort of starts to fall in behind that, and you know, okay, this is the one I'm going to go with.
And in a novel like Three Dreams, you obviously have three sort of main narratives, really. They all sort of have an equal footing in some sense. Was one of those narratives the initial impetus, or did you have what was the image?
The image was reading about sort of DNA and it's sort of four chemical bases, which each have a letter, you know, standing for the chemical that forms it. And it was just sort of these, you know, long chains of these four letters. I mean, that's what DNA is. And so I started thinking about DNA as an alphabet language, like our own, although we have 26 letters, obviously, and reading about misprints, which lead to, you know, terrible genetic conditions. And, you know, that was the time of the human genome in the 90s of trying to plot our genetic map to be able to sort of, you know, deal with those. So that was the central image. And I think immediately two of the three voices came to me. One was the human genome has to have a voice somehow. And the other was, well, this is about sort of child development and nature versus nurture and all of that. So I knew there had to be a mother of children. And it was really the third voice that sort of came a bit out of left field, which is the voice of the crone. I can't now remember where she came from, but I knew it had to be three voices because you have those sort of triptychs of Madonna, mother whore, or mother crone creatrix, you know, those sort of traditional threesomes. So I knew it had to be three voices. So I don't think I had to wait a long time for the crone's voice to come, but I can't.
But you knew there was something there. I mean, because I can imagine it might be initially having the two voices, you might say, oh, there needs to be four
of course.
Bases for DNA.
Of course. But because it was partly dealing with stereotypes of women, you know, particularly the sort of the crone, witch, creatrix, all of that sort of stuff, I knew it had to be three. Mm. So that set the limit for me, which worked quite nicely. I didn't have to hang around and try and think of a fourth.
Yeah. So is that a quite normal process when you have the initial sort of form fairly well established?
Yeah.
And then you have 6 months of sort of exploring plots or themes or ideas within that.
Yeah. And so I say it sort of comes out all of a piece, which it does. But also, for me, that first draft is like play. Mm. It's like being in a sandpit and throwing not sand over yourself, but words. So it is still a creative process. Yes, a lot of it has somehow formed in your head through the subconscious working on it. But it will still come out differently on the page because of the play element. And that play comes from words, from language. Mm. And, you know, that's what makes me not go out to the cinema or not go out to the pub during those 3 weeks, because I'm having all the fun I could want to have, you know, messing around with this stuff.
Do you ever find when you start writing, there's any sort of, not writer's block, because you know where you're going, but you come against some sort of roadblock in that,
well,
the day before the words were flying on the page and the next day
absolutely.
You don't know where to go next.
Absolutely. But then I just say, okay, well, I'll come back to this. You know, now I've been doing this long enough. I trust, okay, well, you know, I've been here before. Let's just push on past, go to another scene or whatever. And it will come. You know, it may sort of turn out to rely on something that's towards the end of the book that you hadn't written at that point. And that, when you come to write that piece towards the end, that might unlock the block, you know, that you just put to one side. And also this thing about sort of, you know, always trying to play catch up with my material means I'm very lucky. I don't have writer's block, because if something doesn't work, because I have changed my process now, I don't have to wait 6 months to do something. But if I've hit a block, I'll go, okay, well, I'll put that aside because I know I've got other projects to work on, and I may get back to that one or I may not. You know, both of those have happened, you know. Mm. So it's about just having the confidence and the belief and the trust. You know, you've written a novel before, from beginning to end, from blank first page to the end, to publication. So just, there's no reason why you can't do it again. And if there's something in the way that seems to be stopping it, don't get ground down by it. Just move on.
I was having sort of three different voices. Is that a useful thing within that? Because you can completely switch, or
absolutely,
were they, they weren't too welded together from the very beginning?
No, because you know, part of the process was thinking about how do they relate. I mean, I describe them as sort of human palimpsests, that one of the voices was informing another one in the chain of three, but that one that it was informing didn't know. But then that one was informing the third voice. So they were all sort of overwriting each other without having any conscious awareness of each other, although that obviously towards the end of the book that starts to be revealed. So that also helped, that they could prompt each other in my own mind. You know, what do they share? And what, you know, where do they differ? Obviously, the human genome is sort of quite polemical in its voice. So it was in opposition to some extent to the other two voices. So there was quite a lot of sort of energy, the three of them sparking off each other.
And how much work? Because it's quite, I think my main reference here is the Not the Booker stuff in the Guardian, and describing how kind of challenging it was.
Sure.
How did you weigh up how much work you felt to do for your kind of imagined reader? Or was that just, you had just a feel for it? You were writing to what would satisfy you? And
I think that, definitely. I mean, I kind of write the books I want to write because they set a series of sort of intellectual and artistic and linguistic challenges. And when I finish writing it, having sort of hopefully answered most of those questions, then I try and work out, okay, what am I going to do with this book? You know? So, and also I feel I write the books that I would like to read, that they're not many of them in the marketplace. So I don't have a reader in mind, other than I assume a Martin Ash reader would be interested in language and words and ideas, but that's sort of pretty woolly and vague. But no, I mean, I put it out there, and if, you know, if some people pick it up and read it and like it, that's fantastic. And if some people pick it up and read it, don't like it, I understand that, because it, you know, it's not conventional writing, or certainly not conventional novel writing anyway. So I have no problem if people sort of, as obviously some of the commentators in the below the line discussion did sort of say, not for me. Well, that, you know, I have no problem with that at all.
Yeah, and I think there's no book that's for everybody.
No, of course, so, of course.
And do you find, in speaking of the words and language, when you sort of write in a burst, do you then go back and edit, or are you sort of editing at the end of each day's session?
No, that 3-week burst is to get the first draft done. So no, I do not go back, unless something is really fundamentally wrong.
So you get to the end of a draft in that time, and then is that draft sort of mainly the finished novel, or do you then go back
the bulk of it is. I mean, I have a curious editing process, in that I think most people use editing to tighten up and to reduce because it's overwritten. I tend to add words in my editing process because I find better word combinations.
Because I mean, that's something that comes across reading it. There's a lot of wordplay and a lot of inventive language. I wondered whether a lot of it, that was down to begin with.
I do add in the editing process. But again, it's that trust of, one of the skills I have, or I seem to have in my locker, is a facility with language. Whereas one that I don't have, for example, is the ability to plot. You know, most of my books don't have plots. So I was writing a book that had a plot, in fact, one of my novels was, I had to work really hard because that's not my sort of natural comfort zone. Whereas the language stuff, I just, you know, I feel so comfortable with it that I can draw on it as and when I need. I don't have to kind of, you know, go off and do research, for example, which I may well have to do for, you know, the plot side of things or whatever. So it's, again, it's just, I think as a writer, if you know your strengths and weaknesses, and either you build your writing around them, or if you choose, no, actually, I'm going to pour most of my concentration to bring my weaknesses up to the level of my strengths. But again, it's the other thing about words is as we've said, it's play. You know, it's inherently pleasurable.
And with the book where you did have to work at plot, had that begun as a kind of intellectual exercise to try and see if you could get your chops more with plot?
Well, the story of that book is I'd finished reading China Melville's book Kraken, which I thought had some fantastic elements in, but was a mess because I didn't feel it had been edited. And I'd been following this debate, you know, where lots of Melville's sort of genre fans, you know, why is he never considered for literary fiction prizes? Because he is, to some extent, a literary writer, although he chooses to work in genre. So I thought, okay, I'm going to write a literary genre book, because I think Melville with Kraken tried, but failed, although I think he has since succeeded. But, you know, so I had not thought this through. Literally, I finished reading his book on the Sunday and on the Monday, and it just happened to be around November time. So I've sort of decided to shadow the, you know, the writer novel in November thing. So I had no, you know, I literally on this one had no notes or thoughts, and it hadn't sat with me. But what it did was it drew on ideas that obviously been playing around in my head anyway. And I wrote a sort of an anti-genre novel, like sort of deconstructing three genres that the book purportedly was working in. You know, I did have to work hard at that, because as much as the fun side was how much literary language could you put in it without alienating genre readers, and also how much cheek and chutzpah can you go with in terms of deconstructing these genres. So that was my play. But the hard work was, at the heart of this, there is still a plot. You know, there is still a goodie and a baddie, and they're sort of tracking each other. So I had to work much harder at that, because I've never written a book.
And did that sort of take away from the sort of joy of the wordplay then? Did you find
I couldn't imagine anything that takes away from the joy of writing, except the editing process, which is dry and technical. But the actual first draft, I've never not enjoyed a first draft. Even a book that has ended up sort of crashed at 40,000 words, which is probably about 2/3 of the novel, but it's stuck. But until I sort of said, okay, I can't go any further than this at this time, it was still fun. It's a bit like puzzle solving. As I say, there are these challenges, artistic, linguistic stuff. And any time you solve one of them within a chapter or whatever, it's very satisfying for the writer, you know. So, yeah, it's pleasurable and it's play to me until you get to the, okay, now we've got to make this fit for a market. Then it gets a bit tedious.
Okay. And you talked about not doing research while you're writing. Do you do any research in that 6 month sort of gestation
not
period?
Really. Or? I mean, you know, the level of my research is probably, you know, Wikipedia, simply because I'm not interested in the fact after I'm writing fiction, but I'm interested in the symbolic value behind that fact. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'll read about insects because I'm going to use that as an extended metaphor, not because I'm writing about insects. I'm only writing about them as a metaphor. They're not necessarily appearing in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
So that is about the level of my research. It's always thinking about the metaphorical value or the symbolic value.
So more to kind of trigger ideas rather than to get...
And to associate ideas and words. You know, there are certain technical terms, for example, about insects. And, you know, that could provide associative ideas for other words and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, and if you think about it, you know, you go back to the ancient Greek sort of classics, you know, Argus eyed, you know, the god that could see, like, you know, has compound eyes like, you know, flies. So I'm not doing anything revolutionary. I'm just, you know, I'm always thinking about the metaphorical sort of version of a fact rather than the fact, you know, in its own right.
And you mentioned you'd switched from writing screenplays initially.
No, stage plays.
Stage plays, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I mean, obviously, quite a lot of changes having twins, I imagine, sure. Otherwise. But were there any specific reasons for the switch from stage
yes,
plays?
Yes, I couldn't go out to theatres and hang out at the bars to network. It was simple as that. You know, I had to look after my, you know, feed my kids through the night.
And is your writing process for writing a stage play, or was it similar to writing...
That's a good question.
Or are there differences?
There are differences. It seems like a lifetime ago. I can't actually get back there as to how I did it. But in the same way as with prose writing, I'm interested in, you know, not plot, not character, because I think in terms of voice. As I sort of waxed on with writing plays, I got less interested in dialogue and more interested in the physical space between actors on stage. So, you know, the choreographer, I suppose you called him, called Robert Wilson, you know, his work, which is sort of very mathematically plotted, and it's about sort of, you know, space between actors and movement. And when you see actors warm up, they often do sort of power exercise. So, you know, they'll be given a situation and they'll act it out. And then the director will give them different ratios. So you're at 9 and you're at 3. So they then have to react. They then have to act out that scenario again, but with these different levels of power. And then they'll shift it again. And that was very influential on me. You know, can you do that? Can you represent that on stage without words?
Mm.
So I kind of went down a sort of, I don't know, radical or experimental way in theatre when I stopped because of the kids. And I've ended up going down similar paths in prose. It's just, they're the things that interest me, you know. Yeah. It's what drives me to keep asking the questions and keep delving into them.
Yeah. And you said that you write as well as sort of longer prose, you work on some flash fiction.
Yeah.
So when an idea comes to you, how do you start to get a feel of whether it's just a moment that might be part of a larger narrative or just something that...
You have to listen to the material. You have to let the material guide you. And a lot of my flash fiction is even more kind of way out there in terms of sort of narrative experimentation than a novel. And you know that you couldn't sustain that conceit over the length of the novel. It works perfectly over 1,000 words, but if you tried to do it over 64,000 words, you know, you'd lose the reader or whatever. You just... You know, basically, has this image or this narrative style, has it got legs for 64,000 words? No, then is it 1,000 words flash or is it a 2,000-3,000 word short story?
Is that something you found from experience? I mean, I write flash fiction and longer novels, and on occasion started on something thinking it's got more legs than it ultimately does.
But that's the beauty of it, because if it doesn't have the length of the novel, okay, well, you know, I've still got something that can be workable here, be it a short story or a flash fiction.
Do you have the same experience that you've started things and then they've not been the length or format that you've thought of? I mean, have you started something that as prose and thought, actually, no, this is more a stage play or vice versa?
No, I've never gone back to stage plays because I'd sort of hit. I'd found that the people who were doing interesting theatre, which was sort of the physical theatre lot, they couldn't understand or see the need for writers. Mm. And I was an unusual writer in that I wanted to work with physical theatre practitioners, but they couldn't, you know, they had very little need or experience of doing that. So I'd sort of, the theatre for me came to a natural end. Mm. I'm just trying to think if I've ever, I have actually. That 40,000 word novel that sort of hit a dead end involved a lot of physics, which is why it hit a dead end, because I'm a layperson in science, you know, I'm not trained. And I became intimidated by the physics that the book demanded. So that finished one day. And then the next day I thought, well, I wrote a sort of time travel-y, but it wasn't really, you know, that was the conceit, but it was about themes about, you know, relationships and stuff. And it's science fiction-y, and my head was obviously still in a sort of science mode. And I picked that stage play up and converted it into a novel. Obviously a lot of the work had been done, but you know, a lot of work lay ahead because it was in, you know, stage dialogue. So yes, that was a case where I took a stage play and which had readings but never been performed, and turned it into a novel. Mm. So yeah, it has happened.
And did that format change have a big impact on the shape of it?
Funnily enough, I don't think it did, because that was one of the examples of the physical space of the stage kept mutating. Because it was the same scenario over and over and over again in different parallel universes. And a single word or a miss sign or a miss symbol could change the whole outcome of it. That was the structure of the play. And I wrote that as the structure of the novel. And because there was a lot of stuff about physical space and mutation of space, that lent itself to physical description within the novel. There is still a lot of dialogue in it because it's these two characters playing out this scene. But so it's both. It was, yes, there was a lot of the original preserved in it in the form of the dialogue, but the physical description, which in a stage direction you suggest with one line, I could go to town on in a novel, you know, have a couple of pages of description.
And with your novel writing, how, because obviously the sort of form seems very important with it. How do you balance that, and how do you start to plan that? Because you said sort of previously, at least, you used to have this sort of ideas in your head that you were letting simmer away. But when does the correct form for the content start to suggest itself, or is it the other way around? You have a formal idea that you like, and then that opens up this sort of concept.
I think it depends on the material. You know, sometimes you can go into a longer project with the form in mind, and that doesn't mean it's going to stay static. You know, you might have to make amendments as you go along, not being a planner. But there are other times where you just think, oh, let's just see where this goes, and something will come, you know, something will come out of it that will suggest itself. So it can be either for me. Again, you know, if you regard it as play, if you leave yourself open to, you know, okay, let's see what happens. Then, you know, more often than not, I find you can get the answers to this. And, you know, what ground me out down on that other one was just, as I say, the physics. You know, there was just some stuff that I couldn't get away with treating symbolically or researching on Wikipedia. You know, I would have to go deeper. And I acknowledge that. And at the moment, that's stalled, you know. So.
Is your background in physics?
I incorporated some in The Wave, which is published by Dead Ink as well. Mm. And I sort of steered away from incorporating too much heavy physics. Didn't feel that was what a work of fiction was.
Yeah.
That work of fiction necessarily needed. And it similarly had multiple narratives.
But one of the things that fascinates me about, you know, particularly theoretical physics, is that in a way they are coming up with better metaphors than us novelists. You know, because they have this abstruse maths that they, you know, rightly or wrongly, they try and make accessible to us, which means they have to resort to words. And they come up with some brilliant, you know, Hawking was a fantastic writer of metaphors, you know. And I find that fascinating. And I also think it's a call to arms for writers to meet, you know, raise our game and come up with some equally, you know, mesmerizing images of reality.
I think that, there's definitely when it comes to sort of describing the conceptual framework of the world that we is around us. I mean, fiction does something really important, but you know, physics is coming at it from a different,
sure,
a different angle, and comes up with some really interesting concepts as well. When they can overlap, I think you can get really good, interesting fiction.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, for me, you know, what they share is you know, construction's reality. And, you know, I write fiction and I'm very keen for my readers to know that it's, you know, I'm not asking them to suspend their belief in order to enter the world, but I want them to know that they are reading a work of fiction. And because that fiction hopefully will work on some level for them to look around them in their real world, real lives and go, okay, this is the reality as we perceive it.
Mm.
But hopefully my book has suggested. Well, actually, no, it might be a media creation or a creation of the brain or, you know, whatever has influenced it. Or, you know, if you're a Marxist, it's, you know, it's unseen forces of class and economic, you know, whatever it is, that is my interest, which is the nature of reality.
Mm.
And I approach it through fiction, not for fiction to interrogate truth of reality, but to show that what we take as reality is another fiction.
Mm.
A pretty damn good one and a useful one and one that works on many levels. But let's never forget that it's actually a construct of the brain.
Yeah. And you can, you know, get a book and it says on the front, a work of fiction.
Yeah.
What that means is very much up for debate because the author can say, none of this is true at all. But that doesn't mean that none of it is true at all.
Mm, absolutely.
Like with physics, the unspoken undercurrent is this is based on a bedrock of truth, of objective reality. And I think what's interesting is when you get to the most fundamental levels, you realize all that is unspun, and you look at the quantum level, and actually there's a lot less solidity and objective reality. But the framework of science is that this is objective truth, and we're slowly progressing towards more objective truth.
Well, that's why it gets interesting for me when that objective truth is put into language rather than maths, because you know language is imprecise and elusive. And elliptical, so it sort of corrodes, you know, the scientist's pure motives of, you know.
But I think when you look at science at its most basic, you know, the uncertainty principle is at the basis of every mechanical interaction, and it explicitly says the ambiguity is there; it's built into the universe.
I mean, my sort of parallel universe piece was structured as both the butterfly effect, as in the slightest change in the beginning, in the opening circumstances, resulted in a totally different outcome of the event, but also on, you know, Schrodinger's cat.
I think what was the wordplay, the idea of writing fiction for me is the being able to capture that ambiguity. It's something that words can do that the mathematics has to be precise and
absolutely
quantify things by its nature. Whereas words have the flexibility to have puns and ambiguity, and that is the way reality is. That there is no ambiguity is part of life. So that's what is interesting about playing with
language. Is interesting because what most books at some level want to, what most works of fiction at some level want to evoke is emotion in the reader. They want an emotional response, and yet our lexicon of emotions on a one-to-one word, you know, one-to-one correlation is pretty limited, you know, happy, sad, guilty, all these sorts of things. So then, you know, authors write, you know, 300-page books in order to summon up, you know, that amount of words in order to sum up one or two emotions. It's an interesting sort of mismatch of an equation or a differential equation somehow. And again, that sort of really interests me because to me, the only truth of a novel is the emotional response that it evokes. Everything else is this sort of membranous structure through the words, you know, through the narrative form and all those sorts of things, which doesn't make them invalid at all. But, you know, it's, as I say, I like to remind my reader at all times that they're reading a work of fiction.
Mm.
But if it provokes an emotional response in them, then it's double bubble, as far as I'm concerned.
You're still looking for an emotional response.
Absolutely. Otherwise, I'd be writing dry, technical...
This is, yeah, well, I think with a lot of the kind of metafictional stuff is that what I admire technically the way things are done. Often it seems to be done at the expense, or that there has to be a kind of knowing irony in it that kind of tries to prevent really letting emotion get into it.
Well, the weird thing I found, you know, because I hadn't read a lot of postmodernist fiction until this year. I set myself the task of reading a lot of the 60s US writers. And, you know, it seemed to me this is, you know, they use all the modernist techniques of things like, you know, stream of consciousness and fragmented narrative and all of that. The two things they'd added, one was sort of collage, particularly with sort of cultural references of pop singers or sports people or whatever. But the other was a sense of play. So they too had reverted to a sense of play, which it seems to be, you have to have a sense of play, especially if you're writing difficult emotional stuff, because otherwise it's just too unremitting. You know, you have to give the reader a break. You know, it's you know, comedy emerging out of Greek tragedy, because the audience needed an emotional break in the middle. So
is that emotional focus of the book, is that something that comes to you from the start when you have the initial image and the idea? Is it married with an emotion or some response you have?
Not at the outset, I don't think. No, I have to find that, you know.
And that happens over the course of the
gestation. I would hope so, yeah. Although the voice, you know, as I say, it come, you know, the first thing is the voice and the image coming together. Well, the voice, you know, the voice can impart its tone. You know, I have to have an idea of what its tone is. So I knew that the genome was polemical. I knew that the mother was, you know, keeping up a happy front for her children, but, you know, was sort of raging inside and frustrated. And that was, you know, she wrote a diary or a journal for that. So you have an idea, but that's not necessarily the effect you want on the reader. Mm. That is the tone of the voice.
But that's already giving you a sort of emotional space of where you're going to start from.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I find, you know, with flash fiction, 1,000 words, you know, you can get the emotional content quotient very quickly. You know, so that, and that's the, to me, that's the beauty of flash fiction, that it allows you to exercise your sort of, you know, your writing muscles in a totally different way and try different, you know, narrative forms that deliver the payload in totally different ways, but no less, you know, sort of exhilarating if done right.
And in terms of the voice and in Three Dreams, there's two female, definitely female voices, and the genome is
I regard female. Her as female, yeah.
How do you feel in terms of recently, especially this criticism of writers appropriating other voices? Is that something you feel as...
Well, I didn't feel it when I was writing the book, but I've obviously, you know, thinking about how am I going to market this and talk about it. I have, you know, obviously thought about it long and hard. So the first thing I'd say is, on one level, I couldn't deny that accusation. But on the second point is, well, if men can't write women characters and women can't write men characters, we may as well all give up. And also, it is a staunchly anti-patriarchal book, Three Dreams. Now, do I have the right to make those arguments? Well, in a sort of free expression world, I think I do. But I put it out there. If people,
I mean, say it was staunchly patriarchal.
Yeah.
Do you feel that changes the argument in terms of writers having writers should have the freedom to explore however dark or twisted a narrative, or are there limits on what should you?
Well, personally, I feel that there are no limits. You can write about anything in the same way as a comedian ought to be able to make a joke about anything, but you stand or fall by what you put out there. So if I wrote a patriarchal book and I got a lot of, from the outside, deserved flack, I've brought that on myself, you know. So again, I've written this virulently anti-patriarchal book. If people don't want to read it because they feel I don't have the right to express those opinions, well, I'll have to live with that, and they'll have to live with not reading the book, and we'll go our separate ways, you know. I mean, I always give the example of, you cannot control what a reader, what values they bring to a book before they've cracked it open. So I could, you know, I could have written a book and the reader is really enjoying it, and then they come across in the middle, there's a scene about a woman who's going to have an abortion, right? If it's a pro-lifer, they're going to go one of two ways. They're going to go, I'm not very happy about this, but I'm enjoying the book. I'll carry on and see where it goes. Or if they're, you know, so sort of zealous about their sort of pro-life values, they go, right, enough. I'm dispensing this book. I cannot go any further. And there's nothing an author can do about that. And again, you just have to suck it up. You know.
And do you think you're obliged to take that at least into consideration with how you handle the material, or do you think that is completely?
No, I write the book I want to write, and if I, you know, if I put it out there in the public realm, then I have to suffer whatever criticism or praise that's going to be, you know, thrown at it, and you know, that's how it should be, I think. Otherwise, why are we trying to put these ideas into the public domain? You know, try to, you know, make people, you know, think or debate or whatever. I mean, the weird thing is, I wrote this book a long time ago. There are a lot of sort of ideas taken from feminism, but they were books that I was reading in my 20s, so 30 years ago. And it just so happens now that the book is finally out, those ideas are still current. You know, Me Too has come, you know, but Me Too could have come in, you know, in the 50s and 60s or in 1920s Hollywood. It's going on then, you know. It just makes you realise that nothing has really changed. So I didn't have to go and research anything new for my, you know, my analysis and dissection of the patriarchy, because it hasn't changed. That's the sort of scary thing.
Yeah, as you see, as we've seen, a lot of the things that have been happening are coming historically from.
And that's the only other argument I'd offer in defence of me appropriating, you know, this sphere, is that I offer this as a man, as someone who's basically in opposition to a lot of the sort of tropes of masculinity and, you know, the male mindset. I think it's useful to have a view from this side of the wall, as it were, that is in opposition to most of what, you know, is on that side of the wall. But again, if people deny that as useful or valid, I would accept it. I would not argue against someone who threw that at me. I would hold my hand up and say, I understand that and I accept it. But there will be other people, hopefully, who will read it.
I guess where people get very sensitive about it, though, is if it feels that there's the cake is only a certain size and can be sliced up a certain way. And if people said, oh, there are not enough books that have a female point of view. Absolutely. And then say, well, look at this book.
Absolutely.
And then if they say, oh, it's written by a man.
Yeah. I have no argument. And I go full tilt at this. This is a book about pregnancy and motherhood, two things I've never experienced. Although I did, you know, do most of the childrearing, but I didn't do it as a mother. So my cultural or gender appropriation is even worse than you know, just writing an anti-patriarchy book. Again, I hold my hand up. If someone wants to accuse me of that, I can't disagree with them. As I say, I would offer the mitigations or the value that I believe in why I've done it. But if they didn't accept those, again, I just have to suck it up.
I guess the problem is it's an imaginative act, isn't it? If there's this whole stay in your lane approach to it and you can only ever write about people who've had exactly the life experience you've had, then we're not really doing the imaginative job.
Well, that's right. And this is why I say if men can't write women and women can't write men, we're all wasting our time.
So thank you to Mark for joining us. Thank you for listening. Lachlan, next time we speak, where are you likely to be?
I might be in Malaysia.
Okay.
By next month.
If you would like to know any more about us, you can find our website at unsoundmethods.com. Is it
code.uk, I think.
Okay. If you'd like to find out more, you can find our website at unsoundmethods.co.uk. Or you can follow us on Twitter at Unsound Methods.
You can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com.
You can find my writing at jamiebatchan.com. I'm on Twitter at jamiebatchan. And at the behest of my soon-to-be publisher, I'm now on Instagram at jamie_batchan. For what that is worth.